Reel one.
Colonel French Blake, reel one. How did you come to join the army in the first place?
Well, it was more or less a foregone conclusion. My father, who was killed in the first war in 1917, was in the 21st Lancers. And although I had hankered after other things when I was at school, I was more or less agreed that I'd go to Sandhurst, and go to Sandhurst I did.
And what year was this?
Well, I left Eton in 1931, in the winter, and so I was at Sandhurst from January 1932 until the summer, I went to Sandhurst in the winter of 1931, and I left. No, made a proper apology there. I'll start again. I left Eton in the summer of 1931, and I was at Sandhurst from winter, summer, and winter. Left in 1932, joined my regiment in 1933, sailing to India early in the year of 1933.
Did you ask to go to India, or were you sent?
No, the regiment was already in India, and as I was going to the 1721st Lancers, that's where I had to go.
What was your reaction when you heard that you were going to India?
Nothing particular. I mean, that was where the regiment was, and I think one was glad to be going abroad, probably, yes.
Had you heard anything about soldiering in India before you went from...
No, nothing. I was born in India, and I left there at the age of one, and except from sort of old photographs of India in those days and what my mother had told me about soldiering in India and Egypt, I knew a little bit about it, but nothing very much.
Did you go out in a troop, Chef?
Yes, I went out in the Navassa, the old Navassa, the new one now. The old Navassa is a very splendid old-fashioned troop ship with sort of cast-iron pillars in the dining room, and thoroughly uncomfortable for the soldiers, not too bad for the officers.
And were you seasick in the Bay of Biscay?
Yes, I was seasick all the way. I was seasick in the Bay of Biscay, I was seasick in the Mediterranean, the gale blew up all the water. I just managed not to be seasick in the Indian Ocean, but I am a very bad sailor, and I'm always the first person on the ship to be seasick, and this was no exception to the rule.
I think you told me earlier that on the Navassa there were some private soldiers who were going out to join the same regiment.
Oh yes, there was always a draft going out. I suppose there were about 30 probably soldiers. There were three of us joining together, who'd all been at Eton together, and we'd all been in the same company at Sandhurst, and we knew each other very well. We were the three youngest officers in the ship, I think. And there was a draft of about 30 men going out. We drew our drafts mostly from the regiment. We drew our drafts, of course, from the regiments which were in England at that time. And I think this draft largely came from the Royal Scots Greys, and included at least two men. Regiments tended to send not their best men on drafts, and they included at least two men who spent the entire voyage in the cells because they were finishing off a sentence for some crime they'd committed. And these two, and we used to visit them, rather like sort of seeing the animals in the zoo down in the bowels of the ship. Rather alarming it was for an officer who hadn't yet joined his regiment.
What was the object of these visits?
The soldiers had to be looked after, and we had to parade on the troop deck. Every day we had to go down to the troop deck and parade with our soldiers, and also to get to know them. And one was given a bit of the ship, which we were responsible for seeing it was kept clean and tidy and so on. We used to have to go down there and see what was being done. Very unpleasant it was. Below decks in a troop ship is really no picnic at all.
Can you tell me why it was so bad?
Well, it's very smelly for a start. there wasn't very good air conditioning in those days, and there were a very large number of troops in a very small space. It was a frightful smell, a sort of mixture of baking bread and hot humanity and rotting vegetables. And fortunately, I never had to go through it because I was always seasick before anybody else was, but I believe to go down there when in rough weather was absolutely unbelievable. And I could never have managed to do that at all. I was already prostrate in my own bunk.
Did you have any problems? Did you and the other officers have any problems on board ship going out to India in keeping the men from boredom?
Well, it wasn't really our job. We weren't sort of directly responsible for the men. That was the job of the OC troops on the ship. And we were only, what am I, sort of loosely attached to our own men, and we had no, really no commitments in that way at all. We, quite a lot was done for, we had lectures and talks and so on India and what it was going to be like there and what to do and what not to do, and I've no doubt the soldiers had the same, but we were really virtually the same as they were, passengers, and we were looked after by other people.
What type of things did they tell you in these lectures?
Oh, I can't remember, you know. It was a certain amount about the status of the Indian and how to behave and how not to behave and what to do and what not to do and so on and so forth. The normal sort of thing you give to troops on the way to any foreign land.
Including advice on how to look after your health and so on?
I expect so. I can't honestly remember. A rather nice thing for me was that my grandfather had been P&O agent in Port Said for many years. He'd retired, I suppose, at the end of the First War. And when we arrived in Port Said, the customs launches and things came alongside. No one was allowed on shore for hours after the ship had docked until it had been quarantined. But about 10 minutes after the ship had docked, there was suddenly a message over the ship's loudspeaker to say, would Second Lieutenant French Blake go at once to the number one gangway? And there I went, where I found an Egyptian gentleman called Zaki Makari, who had been my grandfather's right-hand man in the Port Said and Suez Coaling Company, and was practically king of Port Said, waiting with a large and handsome steam launch to take me off before anybody else in the ship was allowed to go ashore. And whenever I went through Port Said in a ship, in subsequent years going home on leave, this same process was always repeated.
What was the reaction of your fellow passengers to this?
Well, I gained a little bit in status from that moment on.
How did you and your companions amuse yourselves on board ship?
Well, I always find it very difficult to amuse myself on board ship. I like to find somebody I can play piquet with. And one of my fellow officers, George Ponsonby, who now lives in Ireland, was a great expert on the stars, and we used to spend a lot of time at night identifying constellations and those sort of things. And there were the usual sort of ship's games. We were rather, actually, all three of us, rather shy, and we didn't take part an awful lot in ship's activities. We rather tended to skulk and keep away from it. I thought we were a bit antisocial, actually, on that voyage.
What were your quarters like on board ship?
Oh, there was, I think, three of us. There may have been a fourth, I can't remember. I think there were three of us in one cabin, very small cabin with one porthole. And the passenger accommodation, the saloons and the bars and the dining room and everything were just what you'd expect on any sort of small liner of that period. Quite comfortable, quite good food.
What was the first thing that happened to you when you arrived? Was it at Bombay?
We landed in Bombay, and then there was the usual business of unloading the luggage and sorting it all out, and then we went on a troop train from, I think it left Bombay in the early hours of the morning. I think we left Bombay in the dark and went up through the courts towards Hyderabad in the Deccan.
What was your first impression of India?
Well, I think the thing that it takes so long for the scenery to change when you're travelling in a train, the view from the window changes so slowly. You can travel for a day or 2 days and you're still looking at what's virtually the same kind of landscape. And whereas in England, one moment you're in Wiltshire and the next moment you're in Berkshire and the next moment you're in Devonshire, and it looks totally different. In India, you can travel for days and there still looks exactly the same trees, the same type of landscape, same sugar cane, same crops, for hour after hour and day after day.
And was the train journey like a train journey in England in any other respects?
Oh, no, not at all, because an Indian train is quite a different thing altogether. As far as I recollect, the regiment had sent down a servant for us to meet us there, who travelled us in the train, because it was almost impossible to travel an Indian train those days without a servant. And the first class accommodation was a little room with a lavatory off it, and the servants lived in a sort of cubby hole at the end of the carriage and used to turn up, and I think there was, I can't remember now, I don't think on a troop train there was no dining car. The meals were arranged at the train stopped in a station and you got out and had your meal on the station platform. It was provided by the army. And then you got back in and went on. I can't remember how long it took. About a day and a half, I think.
Did you have any duties on the train?
No, none at all. Absolutely none. I suppose we were nominally in charge of our draft. We were responsible for seeing they were all there, but I can't remember that we had anything very much to do.
And what were your first impressions of the place at which you were to be stationed?
Well, my first impression was a really unpleasant one, because my regiment, my tailor in London, had failed to provide me with any trousers for my uniform. So I arrived in shorts, which wasn't at all the right thing. The station platform, the adjutant came to meet the draft, took one horrified look at me. And however, this problem was soon solved, because as soon as I got to my bungalow, my bear was produced, and he produced somebody else's trousers, and I was all right from that moment on. Oh, well, as far as the place is concerned, the station was down in Secunderabad, I think, or it may have been in Hyderabad, I can't remember this distance, and the cantonment was at Trimalgary, which is about 5 or 6 miles out of Hyderabad, and I suppose we drove in some sort of car, or lorry, car, I suppose. And the very first impression I had, you see, being at Sandhurst, one hadn't really seen any soldiers ever. We'd only seen each other as cadets and the NCOs at Sandhurst. And as we drove through the barracks, I know my very first impression was how very young the soldiers were. I expected them to be much older-looking people. And I suddenly realised that they were only mostly 18 and 19 and 20, like one was oneself. And this came as quite a surprise to me.
As a pleasant surprise?
No, but it was just, I thought soldiers were much older than that. And, of course, they were very smart. Beautifully turned out. Everything in India was washed and cleaned and pressed. They were wearing khaki drill, cotton drill, which was kind of semi-starched and pressed to a very fine degree, and it looked extremely clean and bright and crisp, the clothes. Nowadays, I don't think they do that sort of thing. Soldiers' clothes look rather baggy and floppy. But in those days, everything was fitted very carefully by the regimental tailor. And soldiers were either wearing long slacks or shorts, and they were most beautifully creased and smooth and nothing out of place, and leather work, all sort of bandoliers we wore in those days, sort of cross belt with leather pouches on it, the soldiers wore. And they were beautifully polished, and everything was sort of very clean and bright and shining.
Can you tell me about the training which you did in India?
Well, a cavalry regiment, our great deal of our training was concerned with the training of horses and the training of men to ride. And the three main branches of training in a horse cavalry regiment were equitation, which consisted not only of training the horses but also the men, musketry, which consisted of rifle shooting, a certain amount of pistol shooting, not very much, and machine gunnery, because the vicar's machine gun was the most important weapon really of the cavalry. And signal training. The signal in those days consisted of helio and telephones, and there weren't any wireless sets when I first joined in 1933. There weren't any wireless sets in the cavalry regiment. The signal was done by flag and helio and lamp and telephone. Those were the three main departments. And most of the year, 9 months of the year, or 8 months of the year, was spent on individual training, which was just simply training the individual soldier in the particular skill. In order to get proficiency pay, the soldier had to acquire skills up to a certain degree in each thing. He had to be a certain class of shot, he had to be able to, you know, handle his weapons properly and so on, and then he got a bit more money. And we officers were expected to be marksmen of shot, which is the top grade of shot. And we were expected to ride better than our soldiers. And we didn't have to do any signalling or Morse code unless we were actually involved with the signal troop.
Did you do all your training at Secunderabad, or were you sent away on any courses?
Well, courses, yes. Everybody went on a young officer's musketry course, and then you went on other courses as the time came, if you were wanted to be in charge of equitation or musketry or whatever it was in the regiment. You were sent on a course specifically to learn how to teach and how to teach people. I didn't quite finish talking about training. I said 9 months a year was spent on individual training, 8 months or so, and then you had troop training when you, for about a month, when you trained your own troop as a troop. You took it out as a formed body of men every day. And then squadron training, which was the highlight of the year, when your squadron consisted of four troops and a headquarter troop, that went into camp all on its own. And that was nice because you were away out of barracks and away from all the barrack room grind, and it was a very jolly party, and we did a little mile training every day, and then we locked about in camp. We were nearly always camped by a lake where the soldiers could bathe and fish and so on. And then after that there was a big regimental camp, which was also quite fun, and then we'd come in for Christmas, and after Christmas there'd probably be a big brigade or army exercise when all the troops in the whole garrison would go out for a fortnight into camp as well. And we were talking about courses. Well, and the musketry course was, all officers went on the young officers' musketry course to Pachmari, which was in the hills in the central provinces. And later I went on the equitation course, which was a long course of about 8 months at the cavalry school at Sorga.
What was the purpose of the equitation course? Was it simply to improve your standards of horsemanship?
It was to improve your own personal standards of horsemanship, and mine certainly needed improving because I rode extremely badly when I joined the regiment. And also it was to teach you to teach, and how to. And one spent a great deal of time, we spent a great deal of time teaching each other and being criticised for the way we conducted our lessons and things. And it was very valuable. It's given me an ability to teach riding, which I've had for the rest of my life and still carry on.
Who was with you on the equitation course?
Well, I suppose there were two rides of officers, of which about a quarter were Indian officers, actual Indians or Pakistanis, they would be now, and the rest British officers, either British officers of the British Army in India or British officers of the Indian Army. You see the difference. Two rides of officers of about 12 each, I think 24 officers, and I think probably two or three rides of NCOs, a ride of British NCOs, and perhaps two rides of Indian NCOs. I can't exactly remember. And each ride was taken by one, the officer's ride were taken by officer's instructors, and the NCO's ride by warrant officers or NCOs. And we worked very hard, actually, because we had three horses each. One totally untrained horse, which we started from scratch. It knew absolutely nothing. And then a half-trained horse, which had been an untrained horse on the course before, and then a fully trained horse, which we spent more time learning our riding, as it were, as opposed to learning to train the horse and learning to teach other people to train horses and so on. And we rode all three horses every day for 5 days a week, not on Saturdays as far as I remember. And then we played polo in the afternoons when the weather got right. And so we spent a good deal of our time with horses, and we had about 1 hour's veterinary instruction nearly every day. And sometimes we used to do a little sword drill, which is very boring.
When did that consist of?
Oh, standing on your feet, holding your buckle of your belt with your left hand, bowing your legs as though you were standing on a horse, and then going through all the thrusts and parries and things of the sword, because the sword was still a cavalry weapon. And we still carried lances on ceremonial in my regiment, but we didn't carry lances on maneuvers. We just carried a sword and a rifle on maneuvers. But on ceremonial parade, we carried a lance and a sword and a rifle on the poor horse. It was groaning under the weight, and as I weigh 30 and a half stone as well, it was always very difficult in India to find a horse that was big enough to carry me, because we only had the Indian country bred horses were rather small, and the horses we had were Whalers from Australia.
And what were they called?
Whaler, W-A-L-E-R, a Whaler, yes, an Australian horse. And they weren't very big, actually, and I always had trouble in finding a horse which was big enough not to look rather stupid with me on it. And the one I did find had a maddening habit of stumbling every 35 yards. It used to drive me absolutely mad.
So you didn't have any training in the use of the lance?
Oh, yes, in the regiment, not at Sorgha. They didn't teach the lance Sorgha. In the regiment, we used to do lance drill, which is quite a hair-raising business, because it's a very large, heavy thing, the lance. It's something like 9 feet, 8 or 9 feet long. It weighs a lot. It's got a very sharp point on one end and a very heavy weight on the other. And if it gets loose, and it can do a lot of damage. And it's a very the sentries used to carry lance on guard. Looks very smart. But when you turn about, there's a very complicated sort of wave you do. The lance goes round and round and round. It's very good physical exercise, actually. It wasn't bear much relation to the coming 1939 war, which was not so very far off.
Did you have any serious accidents on these training exercises?
Me personally, no. I often fell off. But that's why I rode so badly. There was one very curious accident. It's a kind of bad. A man's soldier's horse backed up a bit out of control, I can't remember, and it went down a well. The well was only just big enough to take the horse, and it went down about 40 feet before it hit the water. With the man underneath it, he got out from underneath and got up, and the rope was let down, he was got up. It was very alarming for him. I can't remember whether the horse survived. I think the horse was killed, I can't remember.
You said that this type of training wasn't very effective for when it came to the Second World War. Do you think that the type of training which you received in India limited your effectiveness for operations in the Second World War at all?
No, I don't. Curiously enough, because Well, I mustn't give you a lecture on what I think about soldiering, but briefly speaking, I mean, soldiering consists of using what you have to the best effect against the enemy. And, of course, by the time the war came, we were mechanized. But what cavalry training did for you was this. It kept you very fit, because it was hard, a lot of hard physical work. Even the grooming of horses, which took such a long period of time of our day, you know, it's very hard work and keeps you fit. It breeds independence in you, because a man on a horse and leading a troop, whatever it is, you're there, you've got no wireless set, you can't ring up the chap above and say, what shall I do next? You've got to do what you do next, you've got to do, you've got to make up your own mind, and you've got to transmit it and carry it out. It's very good for your map reading, because you travel comparatively fast. An infantryman on his feet doesn't have to read the map very fast, but when you're trotting along on a horse at 6-7 miles an hour, the landscape goes by quite quick. And if you're leading a regiment in the dark over a strange track, not very well defined in India, and you turn the wrong way with 700 horses behind you and lead them into a cul-de-sac in a village or something, you hear all about it next day. And you see, we really spent an awful lot of our time playing polo, and polo is a game of very quick thinking indeed, and it's also a team game. You can't win a polo competition with four good players. You've got to have a team, as in soccer, and you've got to work with each other. And all in all, it kept one sufficiently mentally alert that cavalry soldiers converted to tanks made extremely good, the most part of those who cared about soldiering did make extremely good soldiers in the war. And some of the very best of our mechanized people in the days of mechanization were people who had been the most horsey in the horse days.
When you did mechanize, the training must have been completely different then, of course.
Well, yes, except it takes the same form that you do individual training for 9 months of the year. You've got a new subject to learn, driving and maintenance, which wasn't part of horse. It took the place of equitation.